The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. An evening of bells from Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral, an afternoon moment of silence across Europe. The Monday after a weekend full of sadness in a city that has delivered so much happiness to the world.
We'll not give up. And I said to all the tourists, we'll never give up against the tourists.
We are really afraid of what will be tomorrow. When we will be up tomorrow, we have to be united, and we are scared to be divided.
We can say they are bad, but they are empty of love. And we are one of the reasons why.
Thanks for listening with us to the sounds of people asking why. We are broadcasting today from the city of Chicago, and on these windy streets, the people of Ernest Hemingway's city were grieving for the people of Hemingway's Paris, the world's city of light.
How does what happened in Paris make you feel about your own vulnerability?
I mean, it's in moments like these that we begin to remember that we are all global citizens, you know, that we all are participants in, you know, what is an entire universe and an entire world.
There was Stephen from Chicago.
So in this moment, it sort of makes you become very cognizant of your own mortality. It sort of kind of makes you cognizant of how interconnected we all are. And it also makes you realize just how much we do need each other, you know, if not just on an emotional standpoint, but on the standpoint of safety.
Right behind was Juan and his friend Hugo from Colombia.
You know, this is overwhelming, you know, that this kind of stuff still happens. We are, I mean, in 21st century and it's still happening those stuff. And it's a damage to the heart of all the entire nation.
How do you feel?
Oh, I feel very sad because, you know, in this world now, when you see things like that, for nothing.
How does what happened in Paris make you feel?
Unsafe and very, very sympathetic to the position the French are in.
Bundled up for the mid-autumn wind were ladies Abby and Nan, anxious to speak.
I feel very sad that we've reached this point where we can't get along, and they have a different attitude, and it just makes me sick.
What are we going to do about this?
You know, I suppose this will result in elevated state of war, and yet somehow the issues are political and religious, and I'm not sure how much war is going to do.
And just a few steps away, shy-looking and bearded, was Nicola. He was from Paris, a long way from home.
I'm feeling okay, safer considering the terrorist attack, but I would have preferred to be close to my family and friends in Paris, in particular yesterday and the day before. More angry and sad for France and for the world considering this menace. The direction the world is taking towards this hidden war against terrorism or something like that.
All these people, a snapshot of a street corner in a world, a city wondering who's next, what's next, and then a hopeful note. When young Stephen realized Nicola was from Paris, he silently gave him a hug, and then he and his girlfriend and his new French friend walked together down Michigan Avenue in Chicago. We are proud to be broadcasting today from WBEZ in Chicago, the home of President Barack Obama, who's had some things to say in the wake of this tragedy. Here he is speaking today.
Even as we grieve with our French friends, can't lose sight that there has been progress being made. On the military front, our coalition is intensifying our airstrikes, more than 8,000 to date.
This hour, a look at the attack Friday night that has already killed more than 120, and more of the hundreds injured lie on the edge of survival in hospitals around Paris at this hour. ISIS took the war into the middle of a European city and continued their war in the Middle East with a brutal bombing in Beirut targeting Shiite Muslims. More people practicing the wrong religion, according to ISIS. The Syrian city of Raqqa came under intense fire as French airstrikes attack the so-called capital of the so-called Islamic State. With me now from Paris is Sonia, a French-American who was dining outside on Friday evening. Where were you exactly when the shots were fired?
I was at a restaurant around the corner called Clown Bar on Rue Amelot, and I was sitting outside on the terrace when people started streaming toward us, yelling that there were shooters from the concert hall.
And you heard the crowds running out of the club. And was there any sense of what was going on?
Not at all. People were just streaming toward us in the street, just running as fast as they could. So we being on the terrace immediately, you know, we heard shooters. And so we just took cover inside the restaurant. I mean, by this point, all of the glasses and all of the chairs and the tables just broke as people just started running inside.
And some terrified people from the ground pointed at you and said, you've got to take cover.
Yeah, exactly. They were just running as fast as they could and were just running past us and were just like, you have to take cover. Shooters was really what they were saying. And by that point, we deduced that we actually needed to take cover. And so everyone just started running toward the back of the restaurant. But at this point in the back of the restaurant, not everybody knew what was going on. So we had to stay down and we noticed that there were people continuing to stream toward us. And eventually someone from the concert, actually, they were banging on the door to try and let us in because by this point we had locked the door. And this woman came in just with no shoes because she had been running for her life and had lost her boyfriend and had blood on her hands and was just trying to relay to us the information that there were attackers in the Bataclan. And she managed to escape as fast as she could. She ran as far as she could.
What picture did she give you of what was going on in that club?
She just said that there were attackers and corpses everywhere. People were going down and that she was trying to hide under corpses at this point to try and get toward the exit to make a run for it as fast as she could.
Did it seem real?
I was just floored by the whole situation. I mean, seeing the panic on her face made me kind of realize, like, okay, this is really serious. This is something that at this point we weren't sure if it was happening. At this point, we had been receiving reports that it was happening elsewhere in the city, so we were just floored that it was even happening for real.
So the panic on her face took you right into that club.
Exactly. She was just kind of giving us the picture of what it was like, and then at that point, we were like, we need to stay inside. There's nowhere that's going to be safe outside if there's still attackers at large.
Do you have a sense that this is... And for all of the world, your generation's struggle, that this, you know, sense of war, very different from the sense of war in the 20th century, is what you're going to be experiencing for much of your life.
I think that's fair to say. I mean, I was very young when 9/11 happened as well, so I don't think that this is anything that's necessarily new, unfortunately. I think that this level of vulnerability, as you mentioned, is something that has been kind of pervasive in my lifetime and in my peers' lifetimes. And in terms of like different types of security threats that we've had to deal with and kind of adjust our lives to, I think that this is just kind of an evolution of that, of those types of feelings and that type of vulnerability. And so just, I think because I'm older, I'm able to be a little bit more cognizant of the gravity of what's happening.
Sonia, get some rest today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your time.
And thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Sonia's a French-American who was dining outside across the street from the club where ISIS shooters opened fire in the middle of a musical concert. Talk of control of borders now. Talk of assimilation of immigrants. Talk of acceptance of French secular practices enforced by the government. And the fear and anger generated against French Muslims because of the atrocity last Friday all raise issues of direct concern to the large Muslim population in France. Some recent immigrants, but many lifelong French citizens from the time when Muslim Algeria was actually a part of France in the 20th century. Hussein Rashid is a professor of religion at Hofstra University. Hussein, as we talk about solidarity and coming together in the non-Muslim community, in the Muslim community, the response to attacks like these underscores the divisions in that society.
Yeah, I think, John, that you've really hit on something about this idea of coming together as a community that oftentimes tends to be exclusionary. You know, as we see this tragedy unfolding in Paris, we have to understand that there will be ongoing tragedies from this. There's the immediate loss of life. We're already seeing the rise in anti-refugee sentiment in France. But the Muslim community, which has been there for generations, is going to continue to be marginalized. And I think what we see happening in the French situation is it's nearly a year since the Charlie Hebdo attacks. And a lot of the things that we saw go wrong there in terms of intelligence services, we see going wrong here. That, you know, the French state is so interested in watching every Muslim that they're not watching anybody that is actually a threat. And I think it's a concern, and it will only get worse for the Muslim community in France.
What do you think of the secular practices and the call for Muslims to toe a particular line, calls that will probably increase now?
I think the call to secularism, to being French in a very particular way, I think will absolutely increase. And I think it's unfortunate because that's not a way to create a national character. What it is a way to increase further sense of alienation and discomfort with the idea of what it means to be French. In many ways, I think it actually plays into the hands of Daesh, the so-called Islamic State, because it says that, you know, Muslims aren't welcome in Europe. And what we've seen in the American example and to a certain extent in the British example is that where Muslims are integrated, where people of all varieties are integrated into the idea of what the nation state is, the nation state tends to be more secure.
Let's focus on that because that is really critical. Would you say that based on the events of Friday and the particular problems in France right now, particularly with the police and the politics in France, that it is uniquely difficult for Muslims in France to fight this as French citizens, as proud French citizens, because of the divisions you've just cited?
I think it's difficult for Muslims to fight this as French citizens. I think that's the right way to frame it. I think Muslims in France will continue to fight it. I think we're seeing some success in Germany because of what Angela Merkel has been doing there. And I think that it's really the French character of that resistance that will become difficult, not really from the Muslim side, but from the law enforcement side, who really doesn't see French Muslims as being French enough to stand in defense of the nation.
That has to come from Hollande, the president?
Yes, absolutely. It has to come from him.
Hussein Rashid, it's always great to talk to you. You clarify so much in these kinds of situations. Hussein Rashid, our dear friend, is a professor of religion at Hofstra University. Hussein, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Marcy from Northport. The U.S. should help in two ways. Support the refugee exodus so that the military can engage ISIL directly while minimizing civilian casualties, and to help provide that military engagement.
Hi, my name is Danielle. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I think that the U.S. should be more defensive in its strategies and think twice about letting these refugees into the country. I just think that that's going to be a flood that's not going to abate, and it could cost our culture a lot of stability that we won't be able to get back.
Thoughts on the attacks in Paris resonating around the world, and from you reaching out to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Joining us now is Guy Jackson, Paris correspondent for Agence France-Presse, AFP, who has been on this story since the very first moments. Guy, our dear friend Sonia was telling us a moment ago how in 24 hours it went from total mystery to a pretty clear understanding of the who and the what here. What do we know about the attackers, and where are the police today?
Well, hello there. Yes, well, we know a lot more about the attackers than we did yesterday. A lot of roads, I must say, lead to Belgium. But so far, which is obviously neighbors France and has a one part of the capital in Belgium, has a problem with radicalization. There's no doubt about that. We have today had the identification of two more of these suicide bombers. I mean, we need to be clear that all seven of these people, these guys, they all had suicide belts on. Today we have found out that one of them, who tried to, release explosives near the National Stadium in France, the Stade de France, they call it, up in the north of the capital. He's 25-year-old Ahmed Al-Mohamed, and he basically has got a Syrian passport. Now, people are highly cautious about this because we do not know if this has been faked or what. The other guy is Sami Amimor, who's 28. Now, he was known to the French security services. In fact, his family told AFP, which is my particular agency, that he went to Syria 2 years ago, following that route that so many radicalized young men in Europe have done recently. In fact, he was known to services. He had basically a terrorism record for minor offenses, and he clearly would have been someone that they would have been watching anyway, you would think.
And tell us about That's this person who's at large, Guy.
Who's at large? Yeah, well, there are believed to be three brothers, in fact, involved in this attack, who had lived in Brussels, the Belgian capital. One of them is his name is Salah Abdeslam. He is still actually on the run, as far as we know. There were raids in this district of Brussels this morning, but no arrests were made. Molenbeek is the district, so there's clearly a lot of cooperation between the French and the Belgian security services. Across France today, they've raided over 150 places. 100 people have been consigned to house arrest. They've arrested more than 20 people near Lyon, which is a long way. I mean, it's a long way from Paris. We're talking hundreds of miles. They found a rocket launcher, a Kalashnikov rifle, and they found several other, I believe, pistols and bulletproof vests. So clearly they've found some serious matter there. Of course, in France and I think elsewhere, people are starting to ask if it isn't all a bit late. Could they have done more to prevent this?
To that point, I mean, France was on high alert from the Charlie Hebdo attacks in January. If this is what high alert gives you...
It's incredibly difficult, isn't it? I'm not going to sit here and criticize the security services. Absolutely. I live in the neighborhood next to the Bataclan, which was the concert hall attacked on Friday night, which was quite tragic and almost, it's hard to believe, there were 89 people killed there while this Californian band... Eagles of Death Metal were playing, and thankfully those guys got out alone, and they've returned to the States, I believe. But 89 people killed in a concert hall. Now, that concert hall was about 300 yards from the offices of Charlie Hebdo, the magazine that everybody knows now that was attacked in January. It's unbelievable to think it's happened again in France. But it has. These guys appear to have come and travelled on the day, it seems, as far as we know, piecing together things. They seem to have come from Brussels, which is, as again, in Belgium. They had a small car. We're talking about small family saloons.
How widely do you think the crackdown and the sweeps are going to be across Europe in the next weeks and months?
They're questioning somebody in Germany who's refusing to speak. The focus is really, though, I think it seems to most people here, the focus is going to be on Brussels. There's clearly a problem in Belgium. The Belgian Prime Minister yesterday actually said that this one particular district of Brussels, Molenbeek, is an embarrassment. So many things have seemed to be emanating from there. You'll remember the attack that the American servicemen foiled on a high-speed train. The guy in that attack had got on the train from Amsterdam. He appears to have been radicalized, though, in Brussels. There seems to be a problem in Brussels. This isn't to say the French are deflecting any blame. It's extremely hard for us to know which way this came from. Of course, France was on high alert. France has a big problem. France has a 5 million, 6 million strong Muslim community. It's a very, very sensitive debate here how to handle this and how to go forward, just as it was in January.
Well, the debate is going on now with a new passion and a new sense of tragedy. And as you say, the police pointing at Brussels radicalization that took place, Brussels across the border from France. Guy Jackson is Paris correspondent for Agence France-Presse, AFP. He's been on this story since the very first moments. Guy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Daniel Byman, who's director of research and a senior fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Daniel, how closely have you studied ISIS, and what does this attack say about their capability and the vulnerability of France at this moment?
I've been following the Islamic State very closely since its predecessor organizations emerged in Iraq over a decade ago. And the latest attack in Paris is extremely troubling because beyond the carnage and the death toll, it suggests that this organization, which historically was locally and regionally focused, may be trying to have a global impact as Al-Qaeda did in the past.
These men clearly worked with each other they understood who was going to do what where. This is something that takes training, and in terms of picking targets, it all says something about the barbaric policy of ISIS.
That's absolutely right. The individuals involved did coordinate attacks, which is far more difficult than, you know, a few individuals acting together and doing a quick one-off that's not involving others. I'll note, however, that some of the operations didn't go so well. One of the suicide bombers may have had his vest explode prematurely. The attacks at the stadium were less effective than one would have expected. So it shows a group that certainly had some cohesion and certainly had some planning ability, but from their point of view, they didn't get everything they were hoping for.
You know, one of the most chilling moments for me watching coverage from all over the place was a French security official who almost was in tears describing how close that stadium incident came to what would have been hundreds of deaths just there. And that gives you a sense of just how disturbing this whole thing has been to the security apparatus in France, it seems.
That's absolutely right. And making it worse for them, they've been actively looking for exactly this sort of plot for several years now. The French police and intelligence services have been on high alert. They've long warned about the danger of Islamic State and jihadist attacks in general. And as we saw at the beginning of the year, the Charlie Hebdo attacks, you know, really put them on guard. And yet still this attack happened.
Last night on 60 Minutes, I don't know if you saw it, there was a French official who said, this is just the beginning, they're coming. Given the hyperbole of emotional moments like this, if you step back, a concert hall, a cafe, and a stadium in the United States seem to me no more defensible than those same facilities in Paris. Your thoughts?
We use the jargon soft targets, meaning targets that aren't defended, and those are exceptionally easy to strike. And we've seen that in the United States, you know, for example, with school shootings where some yahoo picks up a gun and just kills people, and it's very hard to stop. I'll note, however, that the problem is much bigger in Europe than the United States. They've had far more people go to Iraq and Syria, even in small countries like Belgium, than has America. And in addition, you have to cross a big ocean, so there are far more opportunities to intercept people. So certainly I think American security officials should be on guard, but I think the danger is even bigger in Europe.
Final thoughts on the bloody attack in Beirut against the Shiite targets. Is that just a continuation of their ground war against people who don't believe the way they believe?
I'm glad you brought that up. The Beirut attack is also significant. It is in part their attempt to kill Shia, whom they regard as apostates. But beyond that, they're trying to strike a blow at what they feel is their arch enemy, the Lebanese Hezbollah, which is headquartered in Beirut. We have to recognize that this group fights at multiple levels. It's fighting a ground war in Iraq and Syria. It's fighting a more extended terrorism campaign against its neighbors, so in Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. And now it seems to be expanding this to be global and go after countries like France and Russia and probably the United States.
Tremendous briefing from Daniel Byman, who's director of research and senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Daniel, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Just to bring you up to date on the details, more than 120 killed, injured critically, and clinging to life from the ISIS terrorist attack in Paris, hundreds injured. A Europe-wide manhunt is underway for Salah Abdussalam, believed to be one of the ISIS attackers on Friday. Police say more than 160 raids have taken place, and as many as 23 suspects have been arrested in wide sweeps that have netted explosives, weapons, and other hardware. We'll be following all of these details today. Joining us now is Jonathan Powell, British Prime Minister Tony Blair's chief of staff from 1995 to 2007, Britain's chief negotiator in the Northern Ireland peace deal, and author of Terrorists at the Table. Jonathan, welcome.
Hi.
Why attack civilians in France? No offensive Charlie Hebdo cartoonists here. Is ISIS trying to open a wider war?
Well, it's the same way as we faced attacks in London in 7/7 and New York in 9/11. This is a chance of lashing out to provoke our reaction and to try and lead to more violence in a cycle that helps Daesh or ISIL. That's exactly what they're trying to do.
So is that an argument for restraint on the part of France and NATO, or is that an argument for NATO to get involved here?
It's an argument for having a coherent strategy. We're not going to defeat them simply by lashing out. I totally understand the emotion, the horror, the grief that arises after this sort of senseless slaughter. But we have to stand back and think coolly and calmly about how are we going to end this violence, not how are we just going to get revenge. So bombing them overnight, fine, that's no problem. But we need to have a coherent military strategy and a political strategy. And history tells us without those, we're not going to solve the problem.
Listen now to the words of James Stavridis, who's a former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, now Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University here in the U.S., speaking with the BBC. Is this the sign of someone standing back or an emotional statement, do you think? Listen.
I think there will be boots on the ground from the NATO forces, but I don't think that they will need to be at the level we saw in Afghanistan. I think NATO will probably start with special operations, much more focused intelligence, amp up the bombing campaign. If you put the Islamic State under, if you will, three-front pressure like that, I think we'll see they are not 10 feet tall. NATO can do this.
NATO can do this. They're not 10 feet tall. We heard some of the same kinds of comments pre-2003 and the Iraq invasion. Your thoughts on what the former NATO Supreme Allied Commander said there over the weekend?
Well, I don't totally disagree with the general. This is certainly not a conflict that's going to be won from 20,000 feet. There are going to have to be boots on the ground. The question is, whose boots on the ground are they going to be? At the moment, we're relying on Kurdish forces, both those from Iraq, the Barzani forces from the KRG, and on Syrian Kurdish forces fighting for the YPG. They've been very effective at driving Daesh or ISIL out of their territory. But what they're going to do is they're going to stop when they get to the end of Kurdish territory. And it's quite right they do so. We don't actually want them going on into Arab areas where they'd not be welcome. So whose boots are they going to be? Are they going to be the Shia militia boots from Baghdad? I don't think those would be welcome. And the example of what happened in Tikrit is disastrous. And who is going to be doing that fighting in Syria? So there do need to be boots on the ground if we're going to drive them out of that territory. And if we don't drive them out of that territory, there will be further attacks.
Final thoughts. Is the coherent strategy then to give Kurdistan its nation, use it as a basing staging area for NATO forces, also Turkey as a basing area for NATO forces, which it is already, and have some sort of permanent occupation of Syria and Iraq to prevent these kinds of rogue state attacks?
No, I think that just illustrates the need to have a political strategy. As I said, a military strategy by itself will not solve the problem. If we look back at the conflicts we've had with terrorist groups over the last several decades, or even actually a century, we always start off saying we'll never talk to these groups, we're going to defeat them and destroy them. And actually, if they have political support, we do not defeat and destroy them. We end up talking to them. So we need a political strategy that addresses the grievances, the root of this. The Sunnis in Iraq and in Syria feel disenfranchised. The sectarian Maliki government in Baghdad treated them abominably, and they actually welcomed ISIL as a change from that. We're not going to win them back again unless we have some sort of way of offering them a way back into Syria and a way back into Iraq, address their grievances. And in the long term, we're going to have to offer them a way of talking. It seems very unpalatable now, but without such a way of talking, we will not solve the problem.
Possible talking with ISIS itself. Jonathan Powell is Tony Blair's chief of staff from 1995 to 2007. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, whatever agenda was planned for the G20 summit underway in Antalya, Turkey, it has been replaced by the suddenly very complex mission of what the G20 participants are now calling a global crisis resolution forum. The same could be said about all the conversations taking place in Washington over the weekend at embassies on Capitol Hill and beyond. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us. Todd, is this crisis pushing the world and Washington towards some common ground on ISIS? We already have some sort of agreement between President Obama and Russia's Vladimir Putin. Does that mean they are suddenly closer allies on the war in Syria?
No, I don't know, John, if they're suddenly closer allies despite the optics of the side conversation, direct conversation between Putin and President Obama. Maybe the most important negotiations took place over the weekend were away from Turkey and away from the G20. The meeting in Vienna between a lot of stakeholder countries on the future of a political settlement in Syria, where Russia and the United States, Jordan, a lot of other countries around the region, agreed on a timeline to get Bashar al-Assad potentially out to have a political settlement in Syria. But John, that discussion didn't include Syria and didn't include a lot of the opposition groups that would be needed to effectuate it. So I think there are a lot of questions going forward. There's a great deal of talking, but no resolutions.
It notably didn't include the idea of talking with ISIS. You heard Jonathan Powell just moments ago saying that's right. Really the only pathway to actual peace here. Is the G20 going to be a significant development here, or is it just randomly timed for this event? And what's going on at home?
Well, look, I think what you've seen during the G20 is what I think of as billboard strikes, an American billboard strike in Libya that took out an ISIS leader. Of course, French strikes in Syria that were highly publicized, designed, of course, to show strong reaction to the attacks in Paris. And we'll see where strategy goes from there. John, here at home, of course, reaction in Washington is intertwined with political reaction in the campaigns. And that's no surprise. Let me play for you first Ben Rhodes, the spokesman for the National Security Council, asked about American plans to take in 10,000 Syrian refugees.
We don't think it's an option to just simply say there are all these people who are displaced by a horrific war, but they will not be able to find safe haven anywhere. The enormous majority of those people are innocent victims of this conflict.
Which suggests that the U.S. has to get involved somehow, whether it's militarily or in terms of the humanitarian opportunities.
A lot of the reaction in Washington is now questioning the advisability of taking in Syrian refugees, with reports still unconfirmed at this point, as you know, John, that at least one of the attackers in Paris slipped in with waves of refugees through Greece and into France. You're not surprised to hear that Republicans all over the map, inside the campaign and outside the campaign, are saying that this entire idea of importing Syrian refugees needs to be halted because there's no way to vet them. Marco Rubio was one of the people saying that over the weekend. And I want to alert you, John, to the spending deal that's going to be coming up in December. We've talked about it in terms of Planned Parenthood and Obamacare and everything else. That's a big spending bill. And be on the lookout for moves among Republicans. They've already started behind the scenes to defund, to prevent the president from funding any efforts to import Syrian refugees unless there's CIA and intelligence community sign off on their security, on their background checks. That's going to be difficult, and we'll see if that gains any steam in the coming days here.
Well, that sounds like a tacit endorsement of Donald Trump's Trojan horse analogy on all of this when he talks about security and immigration and the acceptance of refugees. Did this come up in the Democratic debate?
It certainly did. The idea of refugees did. Hillary Clinton answered a question on ISIS and then seemed to sharpen her tone in speeches the next day at campaign events in Iowa because she seemed to stumble a little bit on the posture of the United States versus ISIS.
In particular, Turkey and the Gulf nations have got to make up their minds. Are they going to stand with us against this kind of jihadi radicalism or not?
Well, Turkey is a separate case, and that will come up at the G20 summit. But the Gulf nations, that's a huge issue that will be talked about much, much more over the next several weeks. You were in Washington, of course, where the French embassy and the entire diplomatic row was out in force mourning what happened in France. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I went to the French embassy just to stop by. A steady stream of mourners and people coming to a makeshift memorial outside the French embassy. Hundreds, if not thousands, of flower bouquets, signs, balloons, and lighted candles yesterday. I spoke to one French national, Lucie Leblois, who's lived in the United States for about 25 years. She's an internet entrepreneur, and I just asked her how she's feeling.
Lucie Leblois. I'm from Paris originally. I live in Washington, D.C. now. My whole family is still in Paris. My grandparents were very big figures in the Résistance. So to see them in their 90s now, watching this unfold after what they did so many years ago, for their last years of life, just breaks your heart.
The wavering in her voice says it all. And of course, their granddaughter's life is all about this fear and vulnerability.
Yeah, John, and she wasn't alone. There were lots of mourners yesterday, contrasted with the tough fights ahead on Capitol Hill and in the White House.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
We bring this hour to a close with some pressing questions for France. Questions for our own communities and for the rest of the world as we all absorb this tragedy in Paris. Joining us now is Samuel Laurent, author of Al-Qaeda in France and the Islamic State. Samuel, welcome.
Thank you very much, John.
This is a target of civilians, random people. They could be anyone, yet they are French people and tourists. What is it about this that speaks both to the randomness of terrorism and also to the special relationship that France has with the Muslims around the world?
Yeah, exactly. First of all, I would say that France now is becoming a soft target in Europe. First of all, because we have a very large community of Muslim in France. So therefore, you know, you just have to do a bit of maths among this community, which is mostly moderate. Then obviously we're going to find some people which are sympathetic to the ideas of the Islamic State. There have been even a contested a poll that has been done last year, and that showed a degree of sympathy of 16% among the French people that have been investigated for Islamic State. It was 2% in comparison for Germany and 7% in the UK. So definitely, I would say that France is becoming weaker and weaker under the pressure of both the internal Muslim community that is getting radicalized and also from the people that comes back from Syria. And the number has been grossly underestimated by the French authorities. We spoke about 400 last year, and actually now the European Union is speaking about 1,500 people over there. So obviously those people are well trained, and that brings us to the second point about this attack. We saw something which is unprecedented in Europe, and probably unprecedented since September 11 in the U.S. in terms of coordination and sophistication. We got 6 attacks overall in France that has been perfectly coordinated. We had people that were described by the witness as war machine, you know, like reloading their magazine in a very methodic and calm manner. And the end was also perfectly known for all of them. These were suicide bombers. Not really the kind we saw in Charlie Hebdo and in the Hypercacher on the beginning of the year. Even more worrisome that the organization is totally transnational. Some of them have come from Belgium. We have collected a Syrian passport on the leg of one of the suicide bombers next to the French football stadium, also an Egyptian passport. So therefore, this is something really huge that connects to the rest of Europe and also to the Middle East.
Now, let me be careful with something that you said a moment ago, because I think it is important to be pretty careful at this time. You said that there is sympathy within France for the mission of Daesh. There's also sympathy within France for, you know, declaring a war on immigrants as well. That's going to be discussed over the next several days and weeks. Then you cited a statistic that said 16% of people had been investigated for being involved with ISIS. Now, that could mean that the police are racially profiling Muslims in France. It doesn't necessarily mean that all 16% of those individuals are sympathetic. Do you know what I'm saying?
You're right. The poll has to be taken with a lot of care. But the poll has been carried out by a UK UK polling company. It shows a trend. The poll has been carried out on 1,000 people in each country, so it is not that representative. But you can see the degree of extent of sympathy that you can find in Germany, which has mainly a Turkish community of Muslim that is not so involved nowadays in Daesh operation or in jihad operation worldwide. And then in UK, obviously, the number has rose a lot because we know that UK is a hotspot for Salafia, which means the radical Islamists. So we have to take it very carefully. We can't draw any definite conclusion on it, but it shows also that France is becoming really a place in which we see a lot of conversion, a lot of native French converting to Islam, radicalizing, going to Syria, coming back and spreading the message. And also, we have to say frankly that the French Secret Service are totally out on the cold now. They're totally not able financially, in terms of human resources, in terms of technology. They are totally not able now to cope with the threat and to cope with the size of the threat.
Samuel, 2 final thoughts before we go, if you could combine them, because it seems like they are part of the same idea. What is the chance that radicalization on both sides, conservatives and pro-Islamists in France, could produce open warfare on the streets? And is this on its way to other countries, including possibly the United States, which has a very different population, but the tactics would work at a shopping mall outside of New York City or Los Angeles?
Well, I think, yeah, first of all, for the United States, it's very different in some ways. The United States is more insulated. I would say that in terms of intelligence, you are much better prepared than we are. Obviously, you know, we're talking about much larger scale services with much more means in terms of finance, human resources, and especially technology. So it's very different. For France, to answer your questions, yes, unfortunately, I think we're sliding towards a way in which nothing is done to prevent the emergence of radical Islam, and there is a growing discontent in the population, I would say the rest of the French population. So most likely, I do not see any improvement and any solution in the short term. And there is a high risk that France is heading to the wall. And obviously, that would have consequences for the whole continent.
I want to press you on this. You think France is headed towards a situation where French conservatives may take matters into their own hands if they don't feel protected by the government?
Definitely. Definitely. And after that, more than ever, after what happened, and again, you know, even the prime minister said today that we should expect some other operations, some other terrorist attacks in the near future. So after what happened and in the current situation, definitely it's a deaf dialogue between radical Islam and the rest of France, and no measures has been taken, so there's no way to appease both sides. Therefore, the situation is extremely bleak, to say the least.
Samuel Laurent is author of Al-Qaeda in France and the Islamic State. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, John.
This is Mark Mannheimer calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. Should we join other nations to end the threat of ISIS? Yes, but not with the prospects of losing more of our men and women in direct combat. Have we not learned anything over the last 24 years of our involvement in the Mideast that we cannot change anything? Only lose more of our military, kill more of theirs, and innocent people? A way must be found to talk, to really talk, and try to work all of this out, no matter how long it takes. Killing accomplishes nothing.
As always, thank you for your thoughts. Thanks for listening along with us to the unfolding of history and tragedy and a search for resolve. Thanks also to our wonderful hosts here at WBEZ Chicago Public Radio. More from Chicago tomorrow. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like marketing, meditation, and metalworking. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.